In Acts chapter 2, sometimes called the hub of the Bible. If you take Acts chapter 2 out of the Bible, there is a huge gap left. Because in Acts chapter 2, we see the promise fulfilled to the apostles that they were going to be filled with the Holy Spirit. And of course, we see them speaking in languages they had never learned. We see in Acts chapter 2 the coming of the Holy Spirit. We see the amazement of the people there on Pentecost, the Jewish people from all over the world, hearing the apostles, who they knew were unlearned men, speaking in their own languages. And they knew that something amazing was happening. Peter gets up with the 12 and begins that great sermon in Acts chapter 2. Last week we talked about what was going to happen in the last days, where Peter goes back to Joel chapter 2 and quotes from Joel's prophecy about in the last days God's Spirit would be poured out on all kinds or types of flesh. Young men, young women, older women. And we discussed the significance of the fact that there in the first century, especially on Pentecost and following in the next years, were the fulfillment of the Holy Spirit coming upon different ones. And they were, by the laying on of the apostles' hands, given these powers. Not everyone had these miraculous gifts, only a select number. We see that, of course, being true in the Corinthian church that Paul addresses in 1 Corinthians. So we see this fulfillment of Joel's prophecy beginning there in Joel chapter 2. And he ended by saying, "And whoever calls on the name of the Lord shall be saved." We looked at the significance of what it means to call on the name of the Lord, that it's not simply a mere call to Jesus to save them. It's not just some sort of verbal exercise, not just an announcement. But it does mean that one realizes Jesus is their only hope for salvation. It means that one cannot save themselves, either through good works or just being morally good. But it does mean that one accepts Jesus, His way of salvation, and obeys it, calling on the name of the Lord, as we see in Acts chapter 22, verse 16. Now, in that sermon, now Peter addresses the men of Israel very specifically in verse 22, where he says, "Men of Israel, hear these words." Some translations say, "Listen to what I'm about to say. Jesus of Nazareth was a man attested to you by God with powerful works and wonders and signs which God did through him in your midst, as you yourselves know." Now Peter begins to tell them what they need to know. He says, what you've witnessed in the speaking of languages is the fulfillment of prophecy. Now he says, this is what you really need to know. This is the climax. And he says, what you need to know is Jesus of Nazareth. He says, this man, Jesus of Nazareth, was attested, or he was proved by demonstration to be the Son of God. And how was that done? Peter says it was done by, number one, it was done by powerful works, or miracles, or mighty works. Jesus was proved to be the Son of God by having power over this world. It showed the power of God. Jesus had the power to feed multitudes of people, thousands of people, with just a tiny bit of food. He had control over nature. He was able to walk on water. He was able to calm storms. He had the power over diseases. He was able to heal people who were sick from birth. He had the power over demons, to cast out demons, and he had the power over death. He was able to raise Lazarus from the dead. So by these mighty works, these miracles, these powerful works, this showed that Jesus was the Son of God. And remember, Peter is addressing Jews, and many, if not most of these Jews, knew about these things. As he says, as you yourselves know. You know these things are true. These things weren't done in a corner. They weren't done under a basket. People knew about these things. He says he was also attested to by God by wonders. This kind of focuses or emphasizes the effect it had on the people. The ones that saw these events, the ones that were fed, the ones that saw Jesus performing miracles. And also by signs. This revealed the design or the purpose of the miracles. And these miracles were done to show that Jesus was indeed the Son of God, that He was the real Messiah. So what Peter is doing here in this sermon, he is saying that this Messiah that had been prophesied for many, many years has come. Who is He? Jesus of Nazareth. So he's bringing together those two central thoughts. The Messiah that you've been waiting on for centuries came. He was Jesus of Nazareth. And you should know that he's the Messiah because God proved who he was by all of these signs. He says, these have been done openly in your midst. You know about these. Countless witnesses had seen these. You know, the thousands that were fed by the fish and the loaves. And all of these. And no doubt, remember it had been 50 days now, because there was 50 days between Passover and Pentecost. So during the past 50 days, no doubt, the talk of Jerusalem was about Jesus. Everybody knew he had died on the cross. Everybody knew he was put in a tomb. And now the talk was, the tomb was empty. The tomb was empty. Remember Jesus' talk with the two disciples on the road to Emmaus. We go back to Luke chapter 24. We'll read a little bit of that count to help us remember what these two disciples had been talking about. In Luke 24, beginning with verse 18 and following, Jesus is talking with these two disciples. Verse 18, one of them, named Cleopas, answered him, "Are you the only foreigner in Jerusalem who does not know what has happened there in these days?" He said to them, "What things?" They said to him, "Concerning Jesus of Nazareth, who is a prophet, powerful in deed and word before God and all the people. And how our chief priests and rulers handed him over to be sentenced to death and crucified him. But we were hoping that it was he who is to redeem Israel. Moreover, today is the third day since these things happened. Even some women from among us who arrived early at the tomb surprised us. When they did not find his body, they returned saying that they had even seen a vision of angels who said that he was alive. Then some of those who were with us went to the tomb and found it just as the women had said, but they did not see him." And then, of course, Jesus responds, "O fools, and slow of heart to believe what the prophets have spoken. Was it not necessary for the Christ to suffer these things and to enter his glory?" So Peter there on Pentecost is emphasizing to these people that all of these things have happened in front of countless witnesses. You should know, there's no excuse for not knowing, that Jesus of Nazareth is the Messiah, the Son of God. And of course, that's the central theme of Peter's message. That Jesus, the Nazarene, is the Messiah, the Son of God. And that's what he is going over and over and over in this sermon. He says in verse 23, "You," those of us in Southwest Missouri would say, "you all have taken him, who was handed over to you by the ordained counsel and foreknowledge of God, and by lawless hands have crucified and killed him." Peter says Christ was delivered up to die as a result of God's predetermined plan, His foreknowledge. In other words, it was not an accident. The Trinity, God knew this was going to happen. When Jesus was on earth, He knew He was going to be crucified. He knew that. This was not a surprise. It was not an accident. In 1 Peter chapter 1, verse 20, Peter would later write this in referring to Jesus. He was foreordained before the creation of the world, but was revealed in these last times for you. Before the creation of the world. These things were not an accident. It was by God's foreknowledge. It was by God's ordained counsel. So the plan for the Word to become flesh and sacrifice Himself on Calvary was executed over centuries and centuries of time. When Paul wrote to the churches in the area of Galatians chapter 4, verse 4, he said that this Jesus was born in due time, at the appropriate time, at the appointed time. So all of these things that had happened all led up to that moment. All led up to it. So Jesus' sacrifice on the cross was an integral part of God's plan for man's redemption. It was not a surprise. It was not a mistake. And notice that Peter blames those to whom he's talking. You all have taken Him. You all as a nation, you all the Jews, are responsible for putting Jesus to death. And he says, you've done that by the use of lawless hands. Of course, they weren't allowed to execute someone themselves. Roman law forbade them from doing it. So they used the Roman soldiers, lawless men. And of course, we know that the trials and everything that Jesus went through and his execution was all lawless. It was all illegal. None of it was done legally. And we also know that Christ's death on the Roman cross was a major stumbling block to the Jews. And still is. In 1 Corinthians chapter 1, when Paul is addressing the church at Corinth, in 1 Corinthians chapter 1, verse 23, Paul writes to those Christians there, but we, meaning Christians and specifically apostles, preach Christ crucified, a stumbling block to the Jews and foolishness to the Greeks. See, Jesus being crucified on a Roman cross was a stumbling block to them. Why? Because the Jews were expecting a Messiah, but a particular Messiah. They were wanting a Messiah who would come with glory and power and majesty and all of these things. They were not expecting nor wanting a Messiah who was born in a backward town like Nazareth, who would work most of his life as a carpenter, and then die as a criminal. That is not what the Jews wanted. So he was not the kind of Messiah they were expecting. But Jesus dying on a cross had been God's plan all along. Prophecy after prophecy, whether we go back to the book of Psalms, we go back to the book of Isaiah, and over, so many prophecies about what would happen to Jesus on the cross. So it was not a surprise. It was part of God's plan. We see in Psalm 22 a psalm about the Messiah and His death. In Psalm 22, beginning in verse 7, notice, he says, all who see me laugh me to scorn. They sneer with the lip. They shake the head, saying, trust in the Lord, let Him deliver him. Let Him rescue him, seeing He delights in him. Skipping down to verse 14. I am poured out like water, and all my bones are out of joint. My heart is like wax, it is melted inside my body. My strength is dried up like a potsherd, and my tongue cleaves to my jaws. And you've set me toward the dust of death. For dogs have encompassed me. The assembly of the wicked has enclosed me. Like a lion, they pin my hands and my feet. I can count all my bones. They look and stare on me. They part my garments among them and cast lots for my clothes. That's just one prophecy about what would happen to Jesus on the cross. So his death on the cross was part of God's plan all along. And so Peter is telling these Jews that this death on the cross is not or should not be a stumbling block to you. Then he says in verse 24, still talking about Jesus, whom God raised up by loosening the pull of death because it was not possible that he should be held by it. Now here's the most startling news of all. Peter says Jesus' tomb was empty because God raised him from the dead. The resurrection is at the heart of Christianity. This was Paul's emphasis in 1 Corinthians 15, that great chapter on the resurrection. Paul says, if Jesus isn't raised, we are of most men most pitiable. His resurrection. It's at the center of Christianity. So here Peter is emphasizing to the people that the tomb was empty because God raised him from the dead. And I wish we had time to look at all the verses of the New Testament that state that. It states it in Romans 1, 2 Corinthians 4, Colossians 2, 1 Thessalonians 1, Hebrews 13. There's five different places that specifically said God raised Jesus from the dead. So over and over again, the Bible emphasizes that God raised Jesus from the dead. That's why the tomb was empty. See, the people, it had been just 50 days. The people knew the tomb was empty. Many people had made up their mind as to why it was empty. Well, Peter is up here declaring to them, this is the reason the tomb was empty. Because God raised him from the dead. That's why the tomb was empty. And it was because he loosened the pull of death, the pangs of death, the pains of death. The word translated pains or pangs was used of birth pangs. And it meant that, of course, in talking about a baby, when it's time for the baby to be born, whether the mother is ready or not, the baby comes. And that's what he's alluding to here when he's talking about Jesus. When it was time for Jesus to come forth from the tomb, he came forth from the tomb on the third day. And nothing or nobody could prevent it, not even Satan. Couldn't prevent it. So when Jesus on the third day came out from the tomb, it was because he couldn't be held by it. It was time. Nothing or no one could stop him because God raised him from the dead. Well, now Peter quotes another Old Testament passage, this time from Psalm 16. He says, for David says concerning him, and of course he says, he uses a quote from David because David was highly revered by the Jews. So he says, I foresaw the Lord always before me, for he is at my right hand, that I may not be shaken. Therefore my heart was glad and my tongue rejoiced. Moreover, my flesh will dwell in hope. For you will not abandon my soul to Hades, nor will you allow your Holy One to see corruption. You've made known to me the ways of life. You will make me full of joy with your presence. Notice this is by inspiration of God. Peter proclaims that this Psalm of David is a prophecy of the resurrection of Christ. He says that's what this Psalm is about. And the Jews would be listening very carefully again because it is by David. And they believed, rightfully so, that the Messiah would be a descendant of King David. They knew that. For centuries, in their waiting for the coming of the Messiah, they knew the Messiah would be a descendant of David. And of course, this goes all the way back to Old Testament times, especially 2 Samuel chapter 7. that says from David, his descendants, would the Messiah come. So the Messiah would be a descendant of David. So these people were expecting a descendant of David to be the Messiah. And so in quoting this, he says, the Messiah's soul would not be left in Hades. Comes from a phrase that means the unseen world. It's the state of the dead between death and the resurrection. And we read about it in several places in the New Testament. It's composed of, if we want to call them compartments, areas, places, I don't know what the best word would be, but Abraham's bosom and torments. And of course, if we look at Luke 16, we remember the account of the rich man and Lazarus, where in that particular account, Jesus tells us about those two places, where he talks about the rich man and he had such a wonderful life, and the beggar named Lazarus was covered with sores. Notice verse 22 of Luke 16 says, it came to pass that the beggar died and was carried by the angels to Abraham's presence or bosom. The rich man also died and was buried in Hades. He was in torment. He was in torment. So he says the Messiah's soul would not be left in Hades, the unseen world. Abraham's bosom is also referred to by Christ as paradise. If we remember in Luke chapter 3, when Jesus is on the cross, he's talking to one of the thieves, one of the criminals. In Luke 23, verse 43, Jesus says to him, after the thief said, come into your kingdom, Jesus said to him, truly I tell you, today you will be with me in paradise. Now Jesus did not go to heaven to be with the Father during that time. The Bible is very specific about that. Instead he went to paradise. So this penitent thief did not go to heaven. Why? Because after Jesus' resurrection, Jesus said the following. In John chapter 20, verse 17, this is when Jesus appears to Mary Magdalene. Jesus says to her in verse 17, stop holding on to me, for I have not yet ascended to my Father. But go to my brothers and tell them, I am ascending to my Father and your Father, to my God and your God. When did Jesus ascend to his Father? Well, we know, we read that in Acts chapter 1. Jesus ascends to the Father. Remember, he goes up into a cloud and two angels appear. And they tell the apostles what? In the same manner that Jesus left the earth, he's going to come back. So Jesus did not ascend to the Father, didn't ascend to heaven to be with the Father until the time of Acts chapter 1. So, where did Jesus go? It says paradise. It says, today you will be with me in paradise. In that part of the unseen world. So paradise is where the righteous rest, waiting for the judgment day. And that's what tells them. David in the long ago says, this is referring to what was going to happen to Christ. God was not going to abandon his soul to Hades. Nor would he let his Holy One see corruption. So Jesus' body, when it was placed in the grave, when it was placed in the tomb, while there it didn't experience decay. Didn't experience corruption. But came forth from the tomb. Came forth from the tomb. And the last verse in that says, you've made known to me the ways of life. You will make me full of joy with your presence. He goes on, of course, and next week's lesson will deal with what he's trying to emphasize to these Jewish people about the difference between Jesus and David. David's body was still in the grave. David's body experienced decay, but not Christ. Yes, Jesus is going to come again. He's going to come in like manner that he left. Paul, when he wrote to the church at Thessalonica in the first letter, said that he's going to come with the saints, the holy ones, and we're going to meet him in the air. And the very last verse of that chapter said, comfort one another with these words. Paul said at the end of his writings in 2 Timothy 4 that, you know, he'd fought a good fight. He'd kept the faith, finished the course. Henceforth there is laid up for me a crown of righteousness. A crown of righteousness. But he said it's not just for me, but for all who love his appearing. All who love his appearing. So we're to be faithful. We're to be patient. We're to live trusting those promises that he's coming back for us. And we're to be faithful all the way to the end. And tonight, if there is a need for you to respond to that great gospel invitation, to ask for prayers, then we certainly desire that as we stand and sing this song.